this section of 1 Peter chapter 2 starts what I consider the problematic section of this letter. So I'm entitling this The Paradox and Peril of 1 Peter. And what we're going to do the next several weeks is use these words as a grid and maybe as a way to increase our ability to dance with the scriptures. These are frames we've used before, but I think this is a good letter to talk about them again and bring up some of the problems of this text. And then the majority of this morning is going to be a conversation with Ian Sendy. Ian and I recorded this conversation on Tuesday, and Ian is currently in Uganda. He flew out on Friday, and I thought some of the context around his traveling and what he's given his life for is a good conversational partner with this text in 1 Peter, where we can look at these different readings. So a conscientious reading of the Bible, I know that's really what I was taught. That was the tradition I grew up in. That's not the only reading. So a critical reading of the Bible is like another level. So if you think of the conscientious reading as you're under the Bible, yeah, like you're under the authority of the Bible, a critical reading is more like you're coming to the text and you're over it. So you're bringing, in a sense, your authority over the text. And a conversational reading of the Bible, I'm going to say, is bringing a conscientious and a critical reading in conversation with the community of the saints and the living word, which is Christ. So these relational postures of under, over, and with, I think, are important to name and even understand, like when you're interacting with the Bible, you know, which lens or posture are you bringing to it? And the question I want to lead with is, do you feel set free to dance with the scriptures, to enter a dance, to be in a posture with the text, with the Holy Spirit, with the communion of saints, with the history of this tradition, with the very living presence of God now? Okay, so I am going to share the first interview with Ian. Ian has adopted street kids, kids that didn't have families and parents. He's made a home for them in Uganda. Currently there's 19 that are living in this home. And a year ago, one of the older members, Robert, was in college and was involved with a student strike because the government raised tuition, and was imprisoned and has been there for the past year. And Ian went, probably 9 months ago to try to get his release, wasn't able to, and is going back now, and they're hoping Robert gets released next week. So this interview is some background to that and the trauma of that. And then we want to bring kind of this in conversation with this text in 1 Peter as a way to dance with it. So I'm going to share my screen. Go ahead in the chat. If you can't hear this, please let me know.
The government increased tuition. You know, and that was not the first time. Like, they have just been randomly increasing tuition for students.
Tuition.
yeah, like tuition for, like school fees. And some, some parents, of course, try their level best to keep their children in school, but some of their children, some of the students, are paying for themselves, and they don't have parents, so when the government, raised tuition just before their exams, end of their exams, it was like, it was like a switch for them. So they went onto the, the streets to, exercise their constitutional right that they can demonstrate if the tuitions are unfair. But the government has, not just then, but even to this day, has been very, very, excessive when it comes to gatherings. And particularly students are young people, and young people make up the biggest part of Uganda. 75%, I think, of the current Ugandan population is below the age of 30, as you can imagine. So when the Makerere University, which is the main university, begins to strike, such a feeling catches the whole country. So the government will always come out so strongly to, to label everybody as a political enemy, and eventually, arrest them. Now, unfortunately, my son was part of the young people, who were arrested. It took us time to find him, because now, we got the information that they had arrested him. But where they had taken him, we couldn't find him. But after a lot of diligence and work and coordination, we eventually found out where he had been kept. And we went through a whole court process, of which I worked really hard at that time, and sent in the money, that they were requesting for. This is a very corrupt system. It's a very, very, it's a very shameful system, So now they have arrested innocent children, innocent students. They have taken them into custody, and then they're asking a lot of money from their parents if they want to ever get them. By that time, I did what I could, and I raised the money. And then I went to sleep, and then I woke up in the morning and they had not released him. They were asking for more money. There was this particular day when they set him into court. And we thought we had figured out everything, that they were going to release him that day, only to hear that he had been remanded. He had been remanded in a maximum prison, Lucilla. That broke my heart. And I remember just thinking about this young man's future. I remember just, I could not sit, I could not stand. I was pacing up and about, and I remember just getting into the car at 3 a.m. and just driving, going wherever, I don't even know. My heart had been broken so very much, because I know what the prison system does to the people in our country. When they come out, they're not the same, especially when they have anything political attached to them. And at that particular point, it occurred to me that I had to try to go home and try to bring my son home. Because I had tried to work with everybody in the book, but I had failed. And even the rest of, because Robert is one of the older ones, so he plays a major role in just keeping the home and providing leadership for the young ones. So there was that vacuum, the home was not the same. And I remember that's when I reached out to you, and the Mills Church and all the support that I got, and I managed to get home, and we went through, process after process. And by that time, they had not even allowed me to see him.
Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Sorry
It
for
gets
your
cut out for a
speech.
little bit.
Can you hear me now?
The last we heard was you weren't allowed to see him.
Yes, by that time, we were not even allowed to see him, but eventually we managed to get access. So they made us really pay more money. And this is really what breaks my heart. They made us pay more money. It was quite a lot of money. I can't even quantify it because, as a parent, you're desperate to get your son out. So when they tell you to bring, $500 and that's what you have left on you just run and try to believe that you're doing the right thing to save your son's life. So until when I got to the end of the rope, I had run out of all resources. I did not even know how I was going to come back to the United States. That's when the situation really turned really very hopeless for me. But by the grace of God, I managed to talk to a few people, a few more people, within the system, who really understood, and this boy was not afraid. And they promised that they were going to transfer him to, a more family friendly, situation. And given all that had been go had been taken through, the money we had lost, they said that, typically for people who demarcated as his category would serve for a very long time in prison, because that's how the government discourages young people from, trying to oppose, propose, oppose its agenda. But they promised that they would give him at least 1 year, that if they just released him, that they may get in very big trouble. So they transferred him to this, smaller prison, where I have been talking to him almost every Friday, and encouraging him and just, gauge his state of mind. And he's set to be released in about 3 weeks from now, and that is why it is very important to me that I fly home and really make sure that he comes back. He has lost a lot of time,
Yes.
and also I know, Robert was such a very talented athlete, and he had dreams, and like any other young man, his life was moving on. I cannot imagine his personal state of mind. And I really feel like as his, as a parent in his life, it is important that I go and give him the support that he needs, because I have traveled and I am exposed. I really know that mental health is very important. And that is an aspect people within our community don't take really very seriously. This is a young man who can come out of prison, and people expect him to be the person he was before he was wrongfully taken. And when he fails to cope, they may not be able to give him the support he needs. So that's why this trip is very important to me, because I want him to, to get that support so he can be able to fit back in and, recover and heal, and be functional again. Because I know 1 year is a very long time for you to be wrongfully taken away from people who care about you, to be taken away from your life and your family. So really, that is the main purpose why, I am going home. Yes.
Well, our prayers are with you, Ian, and with Robert. Tell us how old is Robert?
Robert is 22.
22.
All right, we've got more of the conversation. I just wanted to pause it there and just reflect a little bit. Again, I apologize for the technical difficulty. I hope you're able to hear most of that. You can let me know. There's two more parts that we're gonna do, but just to reflect again. Robert, who's one of Ian's adopted sons, is in prison. And I think it's there's this interesting thing about governments cracking down on protest and whether legitimate even in the terms of the government here and there, legal protest. And I'm reflecting on that with how Peter a lot of times gets used, and I want to use this text for this morning and have us kind of read in conversation with, what's going on with Robert and Ian, right? Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human authority, whether to the emperor as the supreme authority or to governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing good you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish people. Live as free people, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Live as God's slaves. Show proper respect to everyone. Love the family of believers. Fear God. Honor the emperor. So here again is this grid that I want us to think about. So a conscientious reading of the Bible is this posture under the Bible, and really you're reading to obey. And again, this was kind of the only grid that was allowed or that I was taught was you're reading the Bible to obey it. A critical reading of the Bible is a posture over the Bible where there's a reading to object. And I want to say there's like maybe some developmental value of both of these, but I want to elevate this reading to object as an important part of a conversation with the text, because I've seen just in the last year, 1 Peter text verses from 1 Peter being used by those in charge to kind of silence and further oppress the marginalized. So, it's like God's authority has been given to, those human rulers to punish wrong. It's interesting that, say, the government of Uganda is cracking down as it exploits students and raises their fees beyond what is reasonable to be able to pay, and then imprison any voice that says that's not right. We see that escalation in our own country, where police and authorities are used to escalate and oppress and silence voices of that's wrong, that's protesting. And a lot of times this can be legitimized by these texts of calling for a submission to the authorities or respect, honor the emperor. And I think there's important objections that we need to bring while we read this text. In a conversational reading, I see is bringing this into a lovely freeing dance, as a posture with the Bible. So not just under, not over, but with, dancing in critical, conscientious conversation with the living word. So with Christ, not with like a static text, but with the living, breathing, present words of God. And with the communion of the saints, so we can have a conversation about this. Now, before I get to the next conversation with Ian, I want to go back to this song that Trent introduced this morning, which I just love. These words, and I just see Ian and your guys when you When your fear comes marching like an army and you hear all the pounding of the drums, when your cries for justice come up empty and you ask in weakness, Lord, how long? You know, Ian, I just appreciate you so much sharing of, you know, the devastation of someone wrongly in prison and then not being able to get them out. Like, the cries for justice come up empty. All the money that they said was demanded as, like, quote unquote, bail that then they just kept and robbed you from is wrong. When they sing with their creeds and confessions, with blinded eyes and hearts of stone, when they pay no heed to your oppression, here is Christ saying, I will never leave you there alone. I love that. And I want to call out prophetically how much these nations, like the authorities here and there that claim some kind of Christian right in the way that makes their hearts stone. The next verse, when they hide behind morals of their own choosing and drown out your pain with their pious games, when they view all your trouble as nuisance, I'm beside you in your suffering. You know, these are just incredible words. And I'm gonna say, like, there's something living in this song to me that feels more alive than when I read, you know, parts of chapter 2 in First Peter. Like, there's something that I'm objecting to in hearing those words that aren't quite able to communicate the life and breath of Christ in the way that we need. So now when I dance with this text, there can be new life speaking, or even using I think Christ uses the objections to even speak a timely word for us now. All right, I'm gonna share my screen again. Go ahead and let me know if the sound is okay for this go around.
Tell me about your boys, you know, who live in the home, kind of what ages are they?
Well, we are a large family of 19.
19?
Yes. And, you know, school has been off, you know, for the boys. So
because of
COVID, for the rest of the year. So they're not going to be going to school except for the, you know, for the four candidates that I have. So candidates are those who are supposed to sit for their, you know, final exams. So yes. Our high school has two, like, sections. I don't know how to compare that to the American, you know, high school system, but we have, like, senior four. So a typical senior four student will be 16 years. I think now you get a comparison, you know. So it would be like 16 years, and then they sit for their finals so they can move on to the last 2 years of high school so they can graduate, you know, and then go on to college. So I have four of those, you know, Joseph and Cosmos and Daniel and Waswa, you know, who are going to, you know, actually they are going back to school this week. You know, because the government has allowed candidates to go back and sit for exams at least. You know, so, but the rest of them who are not, you know, in candidate classes, you know, I know Brian had just joined the university, you know, so he was really looking forward to continuing with his education, you know, but they have to stay home, you know, for now. The younger ones have to stay home. We try to engage them in some little bit of, you know, activities. We started a small poultry project, you know, that has been keeping us a little bit busy and helping to raise, you know, some income, you know, at a small scale. And, So that's how they try to pass their time, especially because we've never had a year when they have to be home, and also because, why it's really very important for us to, for me to make sure that they are doing something right now. These are very young boys, and they have so much energy and they want to experiment, so if you are not vigilant and make sure that they are engaged in activities that keep them accountable and excited, then they may, take a whole wrong turn, and that's what really I always try to avoid, because I know that if by the grace of God, they can be hoped to, to learn how to make better decisions with their lives right now, in the next 5 years, some of these boys are not going to be in my custody. They are going to be really grown and, pursuing their own lives. But I want to have the confidence in my heart, that I did everything humanly possible to prepare them for that chapter when it comes.
Yeah.
All right, I'll pause it there again. Let's see. Sorry, my mic is still too hot. I apologize to that. On my end, it's sounding okay. So I apologize for some of the audio stuff today. So live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. So, I have several thoughts and kind of always just hearing Ian's story, but in talking about adopting 19 guys that are really elementary school to early 20s going to college, and caring for them, being concerned about their welfare, making sure school fees are paid, making sure there's, food on the table while living in the United States. And Ian also really provides, our parsonage here as a place to bring in other guys who need a place to stay, especially those who are seeking asylum and in an immigration process. I was thinking of just some of the incredibly violent words spoken against immigrants in this country by those who are in authority. And I can't think of in a more amazing person in life to say, man, can you not see these good deeds? And this text, like, I want us to dance with it a little bit. And so here are some of my questions around it, right? So first, let's poke at this a little bit. So what if governments are claiming to represent Christian, not pagan interests and traditions? So like when we read this 2,000-year-old letter, live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. What difference does this make a difference? Governments claiming the Uganda government claims it represents Christian values, right? Those in the authority here claim to represent Christian values, yet are almost constantly accusing the outsider of being wrong. And the next question I have, it appears that good deeds are being accused as being wrong. Is it do good deeds from the perspective and judgment of the empire or the judgment of God? Like, who gets to decide who is, like, if the actions are good or not? So if your good deeds are being judged as wrong and even punished for them, like, what does that mean? Because there's this sense that you're trying to change opinion, right? And I think this line is a theme in Peter of, man, kind of silence the voice of the accusers by your good behavior kind of thing. And what happens when that doesn't work? And I think we need to be honest about how that's even used to further silence and oppress people. So here's another question. Do you consider the prophets doing good in their direct rebuke of unjust rulers? So there's a huge scriptural tradition of rebuking injustice. You even see, you know, Jesus, woe to you. He calls Herod that fox, which is a total derogatory term. You know, it's like, are they being disrespectful? Is prophetic speech respectful, disrespectful? If the leaders of the empire accuse you of disrespect, does that make it so? You know, so here's kind of that question of like, who is judging the deed as good or bad when the accusations are being made regardless? So here are some questions that I bring to this text. You know, I think of when Breonna Taylor's the grand jury announced that, you know, they weren't pressing charges, and the NBA teams didn't play. They did a strike, and the vice president was asked about that, and he said, "Well, that's silly." You know, so here's like, you know, so-called Christian leader judging that action as silliness. And I also tend to see this passage in Christian circles kind of being read like, if protest or cries of the oppressed, if you judge those as a nuisance, or, you know, that doesn't really convince me. Or when roads are closed down because of marches, like, that puts me off, and I don't judge that as good, and so it's not converting me to their cause. And then, like, these passages can sometimes be used as then justification for the powerful to keep going on with the status quo. So I'm going to call that out as, you know, deeply problematic. Do you consider the prophets doing good in their direct rebuke of unjust rulers? Is that a good action? Is that a just action? Is that a respect, you know, what does respect the authorities look like? So that's where I feel like, ooh, there's this whole opportunity, not just to like read to obey, but dance with this, make some objections. And then how can even this text train us or teach us? How might we say some things differently? How are we not a part of the problem, but of a part of the justice of God? And I think of listening to Ian's story, and I just think it's so amazing, the care and concern and the example that he leads for all of us. And I see this glorify God on the day he visits us, that though these authorities here and there are making these accusations of being wrong, they may see the deeds that they might be accusing as wrong, But I wonder if there is an inability to see them as right and glorious until God visits them and opens up their eyes. That's kind of what how I understand the visitation of God, right? Or the day of the Lord is a laying bare or an uncovering. The scales fall from your eyes, and then you in on one breath say, "Woe is me." Like I'm undone because I can actually see how I've been wrong. And oh, what I had been judging as wrong was really right. So I wonder if even there's this sense of the present judgment is wrong, but the future judgment, when God unveils your eyes, you will be able to see. Oh, they were the ones who were in the right. All right, here's the last bit of our interview together.
Well, Pastor David, I don't know what to say again. This is such a very big relief. And I remember when they told me about the roof, I had just finalized my ticket. And I'm just like, this cannot be happening right now. Especially because right now it's November, December. Really, this is the one of the wettest seasons we have in the country, with winds and storms, so this is going to be such a big Christmas present, for the entire family, because a roof, in a wet season is something that is very essential, something
Yes.
that is very key. And really, when I shared with the elder team, I just wanted to have some friends praying with me. I just wanted some friends to know that I was carrying something on my back, and that I just, it's our elder team has been a family to me. I always find it as a safe space where I can just say, you know what? I have this going on, and I really need you to pray with me.
Yes.
And knowing, some of the hardships we've been through as a church financially, I wasn't really expecting that the North Church would come through with this gift for my children at all. But it only reminds me of the spirit of generosity that has made me the man I am ever since I joined the Mills family, from the very day, that I became part of this family. So I just want you to know how grateful I am. And I just, cannot wait the expression, as soon as I got off the call with you. I remember I was talking to one of the boys and I told him, guess what? We have a gift. We are going to make the roof. He's like, are you sure? Because I told him, you know what? Maybe we may fix some part of it. I don't know what it's going to be like. I'm like, right now I'm just focusing on you. But so the excitement at home, and I really cannot wait to share with you all those moments, while the process begins to unfold. And Pastor David, thank you so very much for ever being so kind and for ever being so generous and caring. May God continue to bless you as you serve us and as we also, learn to see Christ through the way that you minister to each and every one of our needs.
Well, thank you, Ian. Those are kind words, and you are so welcome. And I'm always happy to be, this to be able to announce the generosity of our own church that makes this stuff possible. So, and I look forward to our community getting to know your guys. It's pretty amazing that you've adopted all of these, kids that had no families. You brought them in and have created a home for them, and somehow you do that from a different country on top of it. I mean, it's remarkable. So I just appreciate you so much. You're a gift to this congregation, and I know to those guys. So our prayers are going with you this week, and we look forward to the sweet reunion with Robert, and we'll be praying for him and you and all the guys.
Oh, thank you so very much, Pastor David. And if I can suggest this one thing.
Yes.
You know, one of the commonest conversation, like apart from just having my 19 officially adopted sons, I have so many, you know, young people in Uganda who look up to me as a parent. And I don't even know why, but one of the things in our conversations is, you know, you feel the gratitude that this young person has to have an older figure in their life that they can look up to, that they can talk to, you know. And I really just want to say this to some of our members here at the Mills Church, that there is no greater need that I have come across, you know, in my entire life, like a need to be loved, you know, a need to be accepted, a need to belong, you know. And I feel like God gives me an opportunity, you know, that when I show up in the life of a young person who has known nothing but hardship and rejection, and I embrace them with the love of Christ, I am transforming that life forever. You know, and sometimes it has been the only thing that changed a life, you know, in a way that I cannot explain. I have so many testimonies when my children call me and they share with me how, you know, their lives have completely changed. And that's why, you know, I really have to say that again, the greatest need, you know, is that need. If you have never grown up without having a family, without having people who are constantly reminding you how wonderful you are, you know, how good you are and how loved you are, you may really not resonate well with what I'm saying. But I have interacted with people and I've been there who have never, one of the boys told me that nobody in his life had ever hugged him. And that the most special moment in his life was when I hugged him. I cannot even, like, I didn't even think about it doing it. I just did it naturally, you know? So those are the things that we do when we begin to welcome the way of Christ in our lives. As we go into the communities, we really touch lives, and these marks we leave on their lives are marks that stay with them forever. Yes.
Wow. Thank you, Ian. Well, bless you, my friend.
You too, Pastor David.
We'll look forward to your safe return.
Thank you so very much. And would you extend all my greetings to each and every member? I'm going to miss you guys so very much, but I'll be looking forward to seeing you once again, and hopefully this time around in person.
Amen.
Yes.
Yeah, I look forward to that too. Yes. Well, thanks, Ian. Peace to you.
You too, Pastor David.
Safe travel.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, friends, so the setup to that last part, I edited it out because you could tell that my mic on that particular conversation was echoey, and I didn't want you to hear, I didn't want to subject you to more than that than was necessary. So here was the part that you didn't hear. Our Advent project last year, we raised funds for our Have Needs, Meet Needs fund, and we had raised a chunk, and we had set that aside. We have done a lot of need meeting in our congregation this year, which has been fantastic, but we've been able to do that within both our normal budget and our normal giving, and a lot of you have given extra to that fund this year. Anyway, well, we had never tapped that fund. And when Ian shared with the elder team that he was flying out on Friday and trying to get Robert, you know, finally released from prison, he had mentioned that the home that the 19 guys live in had, the roof had been destroyed, and asked us to pray about it. Well, pray about it. We want to, put our faith into action. So it was $3,300 is what it is going to cost to restore the roof, which, it's, dollars go so much further there. Anyway, we're able to use that Advent offering to fix this roof for them while Ian is home. And I want to thank you, church, for your generosity. And I know you've got to be moved as I am of just the way that Ian carries himself in just normal living. And I do. I look forward to us being able to make deeper and stronger connections with him and the guys in Uganda. I think some of you would love to, be a part of maybe adopting them, kind of like a compassion child. If you want to help with school fees and those kind of things, just let me know if you want to be connected in that way, or just even develop a pen pal. I mean, I'm in awe. The schooling system in Uganda is completely shut down, so I think of just trying to navigate our four kids and what life looks like different in COVID. I don't understand how he's able to remotely interact with a diversity of guys and care for them so well. So it's pretty amazing. So here's this last section of 1 Peter. For it's God's will that by doing good you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish people. Live as free people, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Live as God's slaves. Show proper respect to everyone. Love the family of believers. Fear God. Honor the emperor. And here's kind of the lead-in that then goes to these different submission sections in this chapter. It's so interesting because silencing the ignorant talk of foolish people, like the foolish people he's talking about are the leaders, right? Are the ones who are doing the oppressing, which I could say in this own text, like calling them, foolish people. Some might not interpret that as respectful language, calling leaders foolish. But so even there's these paradoxes built into this letter. I hope we can, legitimately be free to raise the objections we have with the text and the problems in it. And also read in conversation that's conscientious of like, Jesus, what do you want me to gain from this? And what does this look like today? In both naming injustice and the foolishness that we see around us that further oppresses and marginalized people, it's not okay. It's not okay. And then, there is this interesting piece though that is a helpful, I don't know, governor even in my own life of what does it mean to maintain the dignity of all people, even the rulers that are foolish. What is not dehumanizing them? What does that mean? What does it also mean to not let this text silence appropriate prophetic action and speech and protest? So these aren't used to justify empire. When I think of this, these are the texts that empowered the British Empire to take over Uganda, to oppress and enslave. And that's wrong. Like, we've got to object to that. Yet, is there something that we're called to dance with in this passage? And we're going to do a bunch of that in the next coming weeks. So I'm going to close there. Again, if there's anything that's particularly stirring for you, go ahead and put that in the chat. If you've got a request that you would like us to hold, do that.